Good afternoon, ladies and gentlemen. You're listening to Financial Survival, brought to you by Discount Gold and Silver Trading. I'm Melody Cederstrom. Welcome to the program. My co-host today is Dave Allen, as we bring you our opinion and commentary on today's economic and political events. Today is Wednesday, June 16th, 2021. Good afternoon, Dave.
Melody, it's a day I don't get to share that often with you and Wendy and Todd anymore, so happy hump day.
Yes, I was waiting for it. I was waiting. Well, as everyone knows, we have Butch Paula is off for the week, and I've been in and out of the office, so I appreciate the office is still open and functioning. Carla does a great job in taking orders, processing orders, and getting you updated on your shipping and everything. So thank you. And our producer has been here every day and working hard and doing a great job on the program. As long as Skype allows him to.
He's the one guy who can't miss a day.
Yeah, that's true. That is very true. He can't miss a day. Anyway, thank you, Dave, for sitting in for Butch. You'll also be here tomorrow and probably Friday. We'll probably have a little bit of a replay. And then Butch will be back next week. So let's get started right away as we have Wendy Wilson joining us from Apothecary Herbs. So let's go ahead and see what gold, you know, gold did just fine all day. It was up most of the day. And then the little Fed people, the little Jerome Powell had to come out and say silly things. And gold took a big reversal. So we're looking, and it doesn't matter because basically what he said is really strong for gold. So
I know, go figure. You know, investors are quirky.
Yes. So it's a knee-jerk reaction. I think the point, I'm not quite sure why it would have reacted. Everybody always thinks that gold does bad when they're raising rates, but it's not bad. It's actually good for gold, and particularly under these conditions. So I think that it was just a knee-jerk reaction based on the old premise that gold does bad, and that's what Wall Street will tell you. You know, anything that Wall Street can tell you that gold, something is bad for gold, they will do it. So they don't look at the big picture. So we had gold down right now, $28 at $1,831. Silver's down 40 cents, still at $26.36. Platinum was down 25 at $1,134. Go figure, palladium was up 47, $2,891. That must have been from the comment from Janet Yellen. Oh, we're in a strong economy. So who knows? Do I sound like her, Dave?
I was going to just about ready to say you're getting there. You can take that show on the road soon.
Okay. Imitations of anyway. The USDX today, of course, was stronger, 0.77 at 91.29. Crude oil was down 21 cents, 71.91. Paper markets today, the Dow fell 260 points, 34,033. The S&P down 22 at 4,223. Yeah, it just cracks me up. A rate hike in 2023. Dave, what year are we in?
You know, two full years. And 13 of the 18 said late 2023. 2 years. And it's something we've known since, you know, the Fed stimulus began last March. So it's you figure, haven't we already priced this stuff in? But the thing that gets me, and I'll shut up then and let you finish, is that it's not the precious metal investors. They know. They're aware. They're informed. It's these come latelys that figure, well, they're getting their 5% or 10% portfolio numbers in gold and silver up, and they're all paper investors. Yep. They're all in ETFs, and they're the ones driving the volatility in the gold market these days. It just is very frustrating.
It is, but that's why we look at the big picture. So we'll talk about that big picture here in a little bit. The NASDAQ is down 33 points at 14,039. And the bonds, I can imagine that the 10-year 1.57, that's really popped over the week, up 0.078. Europe last night, mostly strong except for the DAX. Asia was down for the most part. So the three big were all down, not by much, you know, all less than 1%. Well, I guess the Shanghai was down just a little over 1%. So that pretty much brings us to the end of the market report. We have Wendy Wilson joining us from Apothecary Herbs, as she does each and every Wednesday. Good afternoon, Wendy.
Good afternoon, Melanie. Hello, Dave.
Hi there.
Hi, I thought we'd talk about what's going on with the FDA with their override regarding a review of a new drug for dementia. The media and the medical community refer to the FDA, and as you know, as you know, they're really supposed to look out for our health concerns. So the FDA is the authority nearly every health person looks to. And many people recall, hey, when you were growing up, remember when the FDA was highlighted in mainstream news as, you know, they supported the notion the FDA was, you know, looking out for the best interest of the Americans regarding health? Do you remember that?
I do.
Yeah. So today, a lot of people question the FDA's effectiveness in carrying out that noble responsibility. So people are wondering if they really are the watchdog they've been promoted as. And so we're going to look at something here that kind of says, no, they're not the watchdog you think they are. So here we have some reports that are there's a serious disruption within the FDA. In the past, scientists and physicians tend to make up what's called a review panel. These are professionals that would go over the scientific research that gets submitted to the FDA by the drug companies when they want their drug approved. So the panel looks at the research, they ask questions, and in some cases they may even ask for research to be duplicated, indicating they want the gold standard within the scientific research that a study conclusions were not faked. Okay. Now, recently, this new medication came up. It's for Alzheimer's patients, for dementia patients, and the FDA panel went to review it. So, and I mean, this drug hasn't been named yet. It's still under its, you know, scientific research clinical review name, which is usually a number. So the panel, get this, the panel voted no unanimously not to approve this drug. That it shouldn't go on to the market, shouldn't be released. And the FDA overruled the scientist and approved the drug anyway. What's going on with that? Mm-hmm. Here is a question by Jason Kolowish. He's with Penn State Memory Center. He says, despite the dominance of the amyloid hypothesis, now what he means is you've probably heard that in the new news reports that scientists thought that dementia was caused by a lot of amyloid protein and plaque in the brain. And so that's what he's talking about. He says, despite the dominance of the amyloid hypothesis over the past several decades, evidence that links reductions in plaque levels of for improvement of cognition is thin at best. So it's just an idea. It's not been proven, but yet they're basing all this research and drug treatment on that. Jason goes on to say, desperation should drive the funding for science, not drive the way science is interpreted, end of quote. So these actions of the FDA going against its own advisory panel has promoted some scientists to resign from the panel. Apparently, Dr. Perlmutter, a neurologist, felt that the FDA ruling was out of line, and they did not discuss with the panel their findings. So it's almost like it was just, you know, they already decided they were going to approve it before the panel even looked at it. Now, Dr. Aaron Kasselheim stated that the FDA's action is setting a dangerous precedent, and he therefore resigned from the panel. He said, the question now is, what kind of evidence does the Alzheimer's therapy need in order to get the green light? So what he's talking about there is, okay, so the FDA is going to approve this drug. He says, what's stopping this company from requesting now an emergency release, just like the drug companies got an emergency release for the vaccine, you know, before a lot of the stuff that needs to be done on the drug needs to be done. So apparently evidence is that evidence to support the drug is, you know, what it needs to be and what it claims to be is not important anymore, is what they're saying. It's not important. Let's see, this is Dr. Aaron Kisselheim again. He says, even more broadly for this idea that a company can turn around at the last minute, seek accelerated approval when their primary clinical research does not match the level needed for such FDA approval. The FDA's approval was probably the worst drug approval decision in the recent U.S. history. So I'm a little upset about this. I hope other Americans are, because if they're doing this, what did they do about the COVID-19 vaccine? What did they do with that? You know what I mean? What underhanded things got swept under the rug with that?
Or with anything else.
Right. So, and you know, here's the thing. Us taxpayers, get this, guys. We, as Americans, pay taxes and the research money from our taxes. They're paying $580 million through the National Institute of Health. That's what the government's paying the National Institute of Health to do dementia Alzheimer's research. Let's give you a comparison on that. Our taxpayer money going for cancer research is only $6 billion, and for heart disease, $4 billion. But they're sending $580 million through the National Institute of Health for this Alzheimer's, and what are we getting? We're getting drugs that shouldn't be approved but are approved. Okay? So they technically are coming up, you know, with some things here. But, you know, I've always said they're looking at symptom management, not really cures. So that's what we're getting. Now, here's another interesting fact. The Alzheimer's Association did this map of the United States, and they projected the rates of dementia and the high-risk areas for dementia. And the map is good through 2025. So they showed higher majority of these cases of dementia and Alzheimer's at 62% to 72% are occurring in the Northwest states. So Washington, Oregon, Idaho, Nevada, Montana, Wyoming, Utah, and Colorado are at the high end risk. Second worst areas with 50% to 81% occur in the Southwest, South Central, and Southeast parts of the U.S., and then the Central Interior and Northeast seem to be below the 25% percentile. So I think it's interesting. If what could we take away from this map? You're going to find out in just a minute. So there are many explanations why people may appear senile or have dementia symptoms. So we really should be careful to evaluate all the possibilities, and some of them could be just right under our noses. So we have healthcare professionals that admit that even prescription medications can be the culprit for a vast majority of the dementia happening today. So you get the patient off the drug and the dementia goes away. In some cases, medications are now available over the counter that can do that. So it's not just prescription drugs that can do that. The next question is, does medicine already know that certain types of these drugs cause the damage to the brain that can promote dementia? And the answer is yes. Here's a quote from a pharmacist, Noel Campbell, who says, "We find that taking one anticholinergic drug significantly increases the risk of developing cognitive impairment. Taking two of these drugs doubles the risk. And this is very significant and already known in American medicine." So you can get what is called drug-induced dementia. And, you know, I mean, family members don't realize that their loved one is going through this and it's not really necessary. So these are ACE anticholinergic drugs, and a lot of people are taking drugs that are in this category for things like insomnia, cardiovascular medicine, allergy medicine, incontinence prescription drugs. So these are a class of drugs that can create these problems. Here is a quote from Maliz Basunti. He's a medical doctor, at the IU School of Medicine. He says, simply put, we've confirmed anticholinergics can cause or worsen cognitive impairment, which involves gradual memory loss. So here's some of the products that can give you symptoms of Alzheimer's or dementia. Benadryl, Dramamine, Excedrin PM, Nitol, Somanex, Tylenol PM, Unisom, Paxil, which is an antidepressant, Detrol, which is for urgency over active bladders, Demerol, which is a pain medication, and of course Paxil, again, mentioned that for anti-anxiety and depression. But that's just the tip of the iceberg. There's a whole list of these drugs that are in this category of anticholinergics. So remember the map? We just told you about the map and the high risk. So what the takeaway is, based on the Alzheimer's Association map, the drug-induced factor for dementia we could conclude possibly that certain areas of the country may be more disposed to things like depression, not sleeping well, anxiety, and a lot of allergies, and that's why their rates are higher in those states. So, that's something somebody should look at and see where the correlation is with drug sales. You know what I mean?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's interesting.
It is interesting. So, and I just talked to a lady this week who's really concerned about her mom and her memory, her short-term memory. She can't remember names or, you know, things. And I'm like, well, is she on any cardio drugs? Well, yeah, she's on a medication for her heart. I said, is it a statin drug? They're notorious for messing with your memory. She didn't know. She was going to look into it. I said, so it could be as simple as just getting off that medication and using something else.
Are we aware, Wendy, of any calls for transcripts of discussions among the FDA when they were making this interesting decision?
Well, I don't know if anybody's requested those. I just know, you know, if you got experts resigning off the panel, that's significant.
Yeah, that doesn't happen often, does it?
No, I mean, because it's a nice prestigious position to be on there. It looks good on your resume. It's a great accolade to have. I was shocked to read that report, which, let's see, I think it was in the Lancet Journal. It was an article there in the Lancet Journal. Let's see. Yeah, just this month. So Lancet wrote it up. And, you know, letting doctors know worldwide that that's what's going on. So now the public, I hope, knows. But, you know, if you got protocols in place, if you got policy in place, and you've got safety protocols in place, and you're just ignoring them, that's a problem.
Hey, Wendy, give us your phone number real quick. We're out of time. It went by fast.
866-229-3663, and we're still running that Father's Day special. Have a good one.
Bye.
Thank you, Wendy. We'll be right back. Please stay tuned. You're listening to Financial Survival.
Since the beginning of the United States, kings have sought it. Nations have fought for it. It has been traded, borrowed, purchased, and stolen. There is a reason for it. To secure the blessings of liberty to ourselves and our posterity, invest with the security of gold and silver. Call Discount Gold and Silver Trading at 1-800-375-4188. That's 1-800-375-4188. Listen to Financial Survival with your host, Melody Cedarstrom, on Shortwave Radio. Visit DiscountGoldAndSilverTrading.net or call 1-800-375-4188. That's 1-800-375-4188. For the very best in gold and silver trading, call toll-free 1-800-375-4188. That's 1-800-375-4188. Call now.
Melody Cederstrom and CSC Talk Radio team up as Common Sense Voices of Integrity. I personally endorse Melody Cederstrom to be your trusted go-to expert for all your precious metal needs. Experts agree a financial crisis and even collapse is inevitable. Given our government's lack of economic leadership and self-interests of those in power, it's no longer a question of if you should purchase gold and silver, but if you will purchase gold and silver before it's too late. Melody encourages you to tune in each weekday morning. Visit csctalkradio.com. We both agree truth and education are the two significant factors in both our missions. There is a wealth of misinformation out there. Let Melody and Beth Ann help you sort through the chaos and bring you home to the truths that will ensure that you and your family are protected. Call Discount Gold and Silver Trading, 1-800-375-4188, or online at dgscoins.com. Melody and Beth Ann are strong forces together, working to preserve liberty and bring America home.
And welcome back, ladies and gentlemen. You're listening to Financial Survival, brought to you by Discount Gold and Silver Trading, 1-800-375-4188. That's 1-800-375-4188. Well, you want to lock in prices for the Type 2 American Gold Eagle? We will do that now. It's close to delivery. I mean, it's still about another month. July 7th is the key date that everyone is talking about, that they'll be at least be shipped to the wholesalers, and then the wholesalers can get them to us and we can get them to you. So, and you know, what's interesting is I can actually sell these type twos at a little bit lower price than I can the type one. So, get both, get a type one, get a type two, and, it's a nice little collection. So, it's a pretty neat design. It's really different, and, and you'll also do that with the Silver Eagle. Someone sent me something, Dave, that I guess it's PCGS that has a two coin holder of the Silver Eagle, the Type 1 and the Type 2. Somebody asked me if it's more valuable, and I said no. Having a coin slabbed, especially a modern issue coin, is what I'm talking about. Not the pre-33 coins, but the modern issue coins that are slabbed. It gives your coin, it doesn't give it any more value. The only value that's given is the cost of the plastic and having it slabbed. Lots of times we can use slab coins just to fulfill orders. You know, we break them out of the cases, or even we include the cases. So when you go to sell them, it really doesn't bring you any additional value. So, you know, be careful, because lots of time, I mean, if you can buy them for, you know, $10 more than a regular one, yeah, it's not a bad deal. But most of these places will sell them for a whole lot more than $10. So beware of the slabbed coins. There's no need. What is needed is you take care of them. Keep them dry. Keep them, you know, I mean, protect them. Don't touch them. Don't stick them in your pocket, circulate them, and so forth. Keep them in their containers. Keep them dry. Keep the moisture out. And protect your coins. Don't get them scratched up. That's what gives your coins value. So give us a call at 1-800-375-4188. That's 1-800-375-4188. Before we... I don't know, Dave, in the beginning of the program, we were kind of talking about the Federal Reserve, and maybe we could go ahead and you know, follow through on that before we touch on Putin, and if you so agree.
Oh, hey, go for it.
And pretty much what we already said, that that the Federal Reserve raised their expectations for inflation, and they brought forth that timetable as when the interest rates will be higher. They gave no indication as to when it will begin cutting back on the aggressive bond buying program. And so that was, I guess that was a moot point. So they're going to continue doing the bond buying. And they left the they unanimously left its benchmark short-term borrowing rate anchored at virtually zero. But they indicated that these rate hikes could come as soon as 2023. And after saying in March, yeah, just what month are we in? June? Well, March. They said that they saw no increases until at least 2024. The so-called dot plot of individual member expectations point now to two hikes in 2023. Though the Fed raised its headline inflation expectations to 3.4%, now again, this is a full percentage point higher than the March projection. The post-meeting statement continued to say that, hey, inflation pressures are transitory.
I love that word.
I know, transitory, you know.
It's so official sounding.
Yes, but markets reacted to the news. The Dow dropped 300 points. We saw what gold did. The Treasury yields moved higher. Even with the raised forecast this year, the committee somehow still sees inflation trending to its 2% goal over the long run. And but you know what I have heard, Dave, that hasn't been in the news for a while is any updates on their big infrastructure spending bill?
On Congress's? No, there's this new 10-member bipartisan committee that supposedly is bringing forth a new proposal that some people are saying could give and it depends largely on whether Chuck Schumer, the Senate Majority Leader, is going to allow a debate on it, that it could have wheels because it's more focused on the hardcore traditional definition of infrastructure, roads, bridges, sewer systems, what have you. I don't recall the number. It's I'm sure it's between 1.2 and 1.7 trillion, whether that's going to get any or get enough Republican support in the Senate, that remains to be seen. I myself am skeptical, but if there are five Republicans who are already part of this, I don't know. Could get close. But on the other hand, there are plenty of Democrats in the White House and Senate now who have already said, hey, we've given you, the Republicans, enough time for a bipartisan deal. Pony up now or forever hold your peace. We're moving forward on our own, presumably through the reconciliation process. So I think we're still a long way off. We've been surprised before, but I mean, people have been saying that it's critical for something like this to get done. I mean, from a political standpoint, by the end of the summer, I am becoming more and more wary of the possibility of that. So we'll see, right?
Are they going to wait until after the budget is released, maybe? Since we're getting close?
Yeah, you know, I doubt it. I honestly don't think so. I think the real danger in waiting until the fall is that, well, one, there's going to be a month-long recess in August. Then we're going to come back in September, and it's going to be the last month of the fiscal year, as you're saying. I mean, there's going to be probably an omnibus appropriations bill that'll get the government through some part of the 2022 budget year. But then we're into midterm election season. And then all bets are off because everyone who's all the members of the House, a third of the members of the Senate are, you know, stepping up their A-game fundraising. So there won't be, as little focus as there is overall now in policymaking. There'll be virtually none, yeah. Come October 1st, I think.
Wow.
It's
so it's all theatrics at this point.
I think it's a good word.
Mm-hmm. And they do that so well. They should all be on Broadway.
You know, what a great idea. Lin-Manuel Moran, are you listening? I mean, there's another potential here after, you know, In the Heights runs its course.
Oh.
Say, a session of Congress.
Anything else you'd like to add to that, the FOMC?
No, not really. I think we've talked about the most important parts.
Well, then we'll continue on, and we mentioned this, too, as we were heading in, that Mrs. Janet Yellen said that we're well on the way to a strong recovery. Treasury Secretary told members of the Senate Finance Committee today that the Fed meeting concluded that the U.S. is, before the Fed meeting had concluded, the U.S. is well on the way to a strong recovery from the pandemic. And she urged everyone, or the lawmakers, to turn their attention to addressing multiple long-run problems ailing the economy. So how can we be well on our way and we still have long-run problems ailing the economy? Anyway, she said in testimony that she came into her job in January hoping to help Americans make it to the other side of the crisis. Thanks to Congress and its passage of the American Rescue Plan, she believes that we are well on our way towards that goal. And of course, she's also referring to the $1.9 trillion relief bill that was enacted in March. But she says we still face challenges in wage inequality, declining labor force participation, racial gaps, and good grief, climate change. You know, I think we got bigger problems, but...
Well, facing those issues requires substantial public investment, you know, she went on to say, again, urging senators to back the president's proposals for a multi-year $4 trillion spending plan on the broader definition of infrastructure, which includes child care, paid family leave, and, of course, other investments. Now, today's hearing comes amid this bipartisan group of senators' effort, as we just talked about, to hash out a compromise infrastructure plan that would deliver on at least a portion of the Biden proposals. Now, we know that as part of that, the administration has proposed a series of tax increases on both companies and wealthy Americans to pay for a large part of these proposals. Republicans have rejected that strategy.
Okay.
Janet, boy, you know, she just telling it like it is. She I think she trying to get her headline in there ahead of her successor, Jay Powell.
Oh, brother. Anyway, mortgage demand. You want to do this one, Dave?
Oh, I'm happy to. After three straight weeks of declines, mortgage demand came crawling back thanks to a weekly drop in mortgage rates. Total application volume rose over 4% last week, according to the Mortgage Bankers Association. Refinancing led those gains up 6% for the week, although they're still 22% lower than the same week last year. That's because so many borrowers had already refinanced last fall when rates hit their record lows. The refinance share of mortgage activity increased to just about 62% of all applications, up a little over 1 percentage point from the previous. The average contract interest rate for the 30-year fixed mortgage has decreased, or did decrease, 4 basis points to 3.11% last week. Melody.
All right. So since we're talking about home buying, I don't know if I mentioned this. There was a car lot. Somebody was looking in my area, was looking at, there's a dealership that's called Pohanka. And they sell everything. You know, they sell.
Big car dealership.
Yeah, really big. From Kias to Mercedes to Beamers. And I don't know which vehicle they were looking at, but they went on the lot and they were ready to purchase a vehicle. The price, sticker price, plus $5,000.
Huh?
Yes.
Like a surcharge?
Sticker, that's what they were selling the vehicle for.
Plus $5,000.
Sticker,
wow.
Sticker price plus $5,000 because they're not getting vehicles. It's and I was shocked. I mean, we never pay sticker price. You never pay sticker, never, ever.
Wow.
So these are little things that are creeping into the economy.
And that's at a mega dealer like that. Good
Pohanka.
Lord.
Yep.
Hey, when in doubt, well, even the used cars are prices are way up these days too.
Yes, so I was really, really shocked. And it's a very credible source. I have no doubt that's not what it was. I just don't know which vehicle it was, you know, which brand. So these things are creeping into the economy. And the excuse was the chips. And the thing of it is, even if they get caught up in the chips, the supply isn't, the problem isn't going to be fixed immediately. And it's going to be the same way with these homes. You know, eventually it's going to switch. And so it's good to see that, you know, we saw a little bit of increase, but they're way out of, they're overpriced also. So,
yeah.
Yeah. So builders are struggling to keep up with the robust demand and with the elevated material costs. That's another thing. I saw someone where they were building a home, and they says, well, they haven't done anything to it. They dug the hole in the ground, but it's kind of there. What's the problem? They're waiting for materials. They're not getting the materials. And then when they do get the materials, it's what, 6, 7, 10% higher?
Can I tell you, can I interject real quickly?
Sure.
I was at Home Depot this morning. And I was across from the one checkout counter. An older fellow had, oh boy, he must have had 20 pieces of lumber framing. And I guess he hasn't been paying attention, and I guess he didn't look at the prices before he put all this framing onto one of the carts. And when they started ringing him out, he said, now, wait a second. What are you saying? You know, I think he was expecting like $3 or something per piece here, 2x4, 2x6, whatever it was. And it's like $7 a piece.
Wow.
And he said, I'm sorry, I can't afford that. And, you know, I don't know if he ended up walking out or if he ended up putting the lumber back, but there was uninformed, unhappy camper.
Yeah, and a lot of people can't afford it, so that's going to affect the economy. What's going to affect us is we're going into a break, and we'll be right back. Please stay tuned. You're listening to Financial Survival.
Since the beginning of the United States, kings have sought it. Nations have fought for it. It has been traded, borrowed, purchased, and stolen. There is a reason for it. To secure the blessings of liberty to ourselves and our posterity, invest with the security of gold and silver. Call Discount Gold and Silver Trading at 1-800-375-4188. That's 1-800-375-4188. Listen to Financial Survival with your host, Melody Cederstrom, on Shortwave Radio. Visit DiscountGoldAndSilverTrading.net or call 1-800-375-4188. That's 1-800-375-4188. For the very best in gold and silver trading, call toll-free 1-800-375-4188. That's 1-800-375-4188. Call now.
Melody Cederstrom and CSE Talk Radio team up as Common Sense Voices of Integrity. I personally endorse Melody Cederstrom to be your trusted go-to expert for all your precious metal needs. Experts agree a financial crisis and even collapse is inevitable. Given our government's lack of economic leadership and self-interests of those in power, it's no longer a question of if you should purchase gold and silver, but if you will purchase gold and silver before it's too late. Melody encourages you to tune in each weekday morning. Visit CSETalkRadio.com. We both agree truth and education are the two significant factors in both our missions. There is a wealth of misinformation out there. Let Melody and Beth Ann help you sort through the chaos and bring you home to the truths that will ensure that you and your family are protected. Call Discount Gold and Silver Trading, 1-800-375-4188, or online at DGScoins.com. Melody and Beth Ann are strong forces together, working to preserve liberty and bring America home.
And one more time, welcome back to Financial Survival, brought to you by Discount Gold and Silver Trading. I'm Dave Allen. Melody, off this final segment. We mentioned it at the top of the program, the ever anticipated or highly anticipated Biden-Putin talks were today in Geneva. And as a result, we're being told the U.S. and Russia will return their ambassadors to their posts, and the two sides have agreed to hold future talks on arms control, cybersecurity, and diplomatic ties, at least according to Vladimir Putin in his press conference after the summit meeting with President Joe Biden ended. Putin told reporters, we agreed that they, the ambassadors, would return to their service. As for the timeline, tomorrow or the day after, this is a technical question. Putin said the talks with Biden took place without any hostile atmosphere, and each side understood each other's red lines on issues of contention. Russia's ambassador to the U.S., Anatoly Antonov, was recalled earlier this year after the U.S. expelled a group of other diplomats. The U.S. Envoy to Russia, John Sullivan, then left Moscow as tensions continued rising. Both of them were in Geneva for today's summit and appeared in photos with the two presidents. Now, while a follow-up meeting would be a tangible outcome of today and a symbolic next step, both countries have downplayed expectation for any structural changes to emerge from these talks. Putin said Biden raised the case of jailed opposition leader Alexei Navalny. Putin claimed that Navalny had sought deliberately to be arrested after his return to Russia in January. Navalny, we know, had been in Germany recovering from a nerve agent poisoning that the U.S. has blamed on Putin's security service, a charge the Kremlin strenuously denies. Now, today's summit was substantially shorter than aides had predicted, ending after about 2.5 hours of talks. As U.S. officials had been expecting, the meetings could last between 4 to 5 hours. Biden was seen giving a thumbs up to reporters as he left the meeting ahead of his press conference, where he mostly confirmed things that Putin had said earlier. Now, the Putin-Biden summit was closely watched around the world as U.S.-Russia relations do remain tense after a slew of geopolitical clashes and international sanctions in the recent past. Besides Navalny, Russia's annexation of Crimea from Ukraine in 2014 got it suspended from the then Group of Eight and urged international sanctions. Since then, Russia's been accused of 2016 U.S. election meddling, two nerve agent attacks, as well as involvement or knowledge of cyber attacks and various human rights abuses. Russia's always denied the multiple accusations leveled against it, saying it's a victim of anti-Russian sentiment in the West. Well, Vladimir, which came first, the chicken or the egg? In other news, that mainly driving markets today, at least earlier, before Yellen's comments and the Fed's Powell's press conference, reports say China's set to try to control inflated raw commodity prices. Seeing the Chinese government says it's going to intervene after copper, iron ore, and coal prices rose to record highs recently. The state-owned Asset Supervision and Administration Commission ordered China's businesses to control risks and limit their exposure to overseas commodity markets. Don't know. I haven't seen that includes gold. I doubt it does. Companies have been ordered to report their futures positions to the commission. China also said its National Food and Strategic Reserves Administration will soon release stockpiles of metals. That includes copper, aluminum, and zinc, which will reportedly be sold directly to manufacturers. I'm sure those metals have taken a nosedive since that announcement today. China's industrial output was reported rising almost 9% in May year over year, which was actually in line with market expectations. Now, in other overnight news, consumer prices in the UK rose 2.1% last month. That's the highest level since July of 2019. That's a year-over-year number. Not surprisingly, the hot inflation number increased speculation about the timing of the Bank of England's tightening its monetary. And unfortunately, Israeli warplanes carried out a series of strikes at the Hamas militant sites in the Gaza Strip today, the first raid since the ceasefire ended the 11-day war with Hamas last month. Given all this news, boy, it's really surprising that gold and silver prices were just up modestly earlier today, and to the extent they fell later. I'll be back tomorrow. U.S. import prices increased more than expected last month as the cost of petroleum products rose and supply chain bottlenecks boosted prices of other goods, adding to signs that inflation was heating up amid a reopening economy. Import prices rose 1.1% last month after gaining 0.8% in April. It's according to the Labor Department's report released this morning. The seventh straight monthly gain lifted the year-over-year increase to 11.3%. That's the largest rise since September 2011. Import prices surged 10.8% on a year-over-year basis in April. Economists had been forecasting import prices, which exclude tariffs, rising just 0.8%. Part of the acceleration in the year-over-year prices reflected the dropping of last spring's weak readings from the calculation. Makes sense. Data this month showed strong increases in producer and consumer prices in May, as we reported earlier in the week and last week. COVID vaccinations and trillions of dollars from the government and the Fed, and again, record low interest rates continue to whip up demand. It's leaving companies scrambling for raw materials and labor. We're seeing this almost everywhere. But the higher inflation is largely viewed as transitory, with supply chains expected to eventually adjust. Although some of those expectations are saying, well, be patient, it might not be until next year. Imported fuel prices jumped 4% last month after rising 1.5% in April. Petroleum prices increased 3.8%. The cost of imported food, though, fell 0.4%. It also showed export prices jumping 2.2% in May after rising 1.1% in April. Prices for agricultural exports rose 6.1%. That's the largest gain since November of 2010. Export prices year over year surged 17.4%. That's the largest rise since the series started in September of, is that 1983? Yes, 1983. Phew. Now, speaking of inflation, no central banker in the world is taking it on this year like Roberto Campos Neto. In March, the head of Brazil's central bank shocked traders in Sao Paulo with a bigger-than-expected interest rate hike of 75 basis points. It was a classic central banking gambit executed by the grandson, actually, of one of Brazil's reported preeminent economic minds. Unleash a great show of force from the outset to prove you're a true inflation fighter, and you'll quickly drive down investors' inflation expectations and even possibly ease the need for additional hikes. Well, in actuality, for good measure, Campos Neto and the bank board raised another 75 basis points last month, and by their own indications, they're going to do the same at today's or tomorrow's policy meeting in Brasilia, taking the benchmark Selic to 4.25%. And yet, his bold plan doesn't appear to be working. It's the key here. A key bond market measure of inflation expectations has barely budged since that first rate hike back in March. What's more, inflation forecasts in the central bank's weekly survey of economists have gone up, not down over that time. Just yesterday, they lifted their estimates for this year and next to 5.82 and 3.78, both above target. Now, much of this, in fairness, is explained by things cut out of Campos Neto's control, a large government budget deficit, soaring global commodity prices, and actually a severe drought that's driving up electricity bills in Brazil big time. All these elements are conspiring against the central bank and in the process raising a crucial question. Is the former trader ready to signal the bank will even get more aggressive with its rate hikes, even though that may undermine the economy's recovery from its collapse? Or will he balk and risk letting inflation take off? What I hope they understand is that what they are doing is not working. It's not stopping expectations. You have to do something different. Well, so says Tony Volpon, a former Brazilian central bank director. Inflation expectations for next year in particular aren't responding to the aggressive rate hike so far this year. That's because many economists disagree with the central bank's indication that it won't need to withdraw all of its monetary stimulus to control inflation. And that's just moving fast with the tightening. And that just moving fast with the tightening cycle will do the trick. Now, pressed on the issue, Campos Neto said last week that the so-called partial normalization of their monetary policy, which there means keeping a certain level of stimulus in place, isn't a blind promise by the central bank, but just an effort at transparency. Hey, you go, boy. He added that the bank's decisions are data-driven and, most importantly, that it remains 100% committed to the inflation target, which stands at 3.5% for next year. That's why most economists are now expecting that Campos Neto, to make good on that promise, will remove any indication of future rate actions from the bank's communications and opt for a simpler approach, saying only that policymakers will do whatever's necessary to rein in prices. David Beaker, who heads Brazil's Bank of America Securities, said no one can criticize transparency, but it will also add volatility in the short term. It's like they're doing two meetings in one. So interesting for our neighbors just a couple thousand miles south of us. Now, question. Have you received your 2019 tax refund or your stimulus check on time? If, like me, your answer is no, you're not alone. In fact, the new report given to Congress by the IRS Taxpayer Advocate Division says you're one of millions who experienced that setback. Unfortunately, you also might be one of the many who felt like they were being left in the dark. The Advocates report gave the IRS kudos, actually, for managing the 2020 filing season and accurately paying the significant majority of economic impact payments and stimulus checks. But it also noted that some taxpayers experienced major problems and that the agency didn't do everything it could have done when it came to being transparent about its struggles. One of those struggles was operating during the pandemic. As a result, paper tax returns and correspondence from taxpayers sat unopened in trailers for months, some like mine, for over a year. Taxpayers at a near impossible time getting through to the IRS by phone, and they couldn't get in-person assistance at taxpayer assistance centers because they weren't there. The Taxpayer Advocate Division said the IRS was unable to open and process roughly 16 million paper tax returns in a timely manner. But the report found that the majority of those taxpayers likely were entitled to refunds, yet they had to wait a lot longer than usual to get them. According to an updated post on the IRS website, there are still 7.1 million unprocessed individual returns and 2.3 million unprocessed business returns as of the last November, with some dated as early as due date April 15th. Adding the IRS challenges was certainly the 2020 CARES Act, which put the responsibility of delivering more than 160 million stimulus checks on the agency's shoulders. The good news, not all taxpayers were affected by the slowdown. The report stated that taxpayers who filed returns electronically had a much easier time securing refunds and stimulus pay. I don't believe we have enough time to go into the next story, and Todd is confirming that. So we're going to end there. That's all the time we have for today's show. Thanks again to all our listeners tuning in. We'll talk to you tomorrow. Bye-bye.